It's the JT the Brick Show, broadcasting live from the Finley Cadillac Performance Studio.
Raiders bring a blitz. He takes up off the middle, and he's wrapped up from behind. Max Crosby.
Your silver and black home to sound off for over 20 years.
Open at the 35, racing to the 20, 10, touchdown Raiders.
And now, here's JT the Brick.
They're learning, you know, and I think Dante is a unique in terms of he's just a hair under 6'5", you know, and he ran 4.3. There's not a lot of humans on this planet that do that, you know, and I think if you had to draw up an outside receiver, you would pick that type of body type, someone that's got length, someone that's got a huge catch radius, but also has speed. You know, sometimes you can get a big guy like that, but he can't really run, so they can stay with him. So, you know, you add that speed element to him, his ability to sink his hips, his ability to get in and out of cuts. But for all of those guys, they're all learning a new system. So some of them came from, you know, I think Ashton was probably fortunate coming from Dirk's system at Boise because it's a little bit more pro-friendly. Some other guys are playing up-tempo, throwing the ball all over, one-word calls and going. And so everybody's on a different level when they come in, and it's just a matter of them getting acclimated, and Chris Beatty's doing a great job with those guys, but they've shown that they're good players, and I will continue to see how they go.
That's Raiders offensive coordinator Chip Kelly, and he's going to set the tone for our show today. By the way, I'm Vinny Bonsignor. I'm sitting in for JT the Brick. We'll be here all week, 12 to 2, as JT takes some well-deserved time off. Talking, Chip Kelly alluding to Jack Besh and Dante Thornton, the two young wide receivers, and our show today talking about what's the Raiders' pecking order when it comes to their targets. We're going to throw Brock Bowers and Michael Mayer in there as well. You know, the two young tight ends that I think are going to be focal points of this offense, especially Brock Bowers. I think he's going to be the fuel of this offense. I think it's all going to be funneled through him. And then everybody sets their clock and their watch to Brock Bowers. So when you're talking about Brock Bowers as the 1A in terms of the targets, and then obviously Jacoby Myers being the decided number two in terms of that pecking order for the targets, where does everybody else fall into line after that? And I want your thoughts, 702-365-9200, whether you call us or text us, let us know what your thoughts are on how this is all going to play out. The Raiders really paid a pretty penny at the wide receiver position during the draft, committing a second-round pick, a fourth-round pick, and then a seventh-round pick to that room with some young, dynamic players, all kinds of different shapes and sizes and skill sets. When you're talking about Dante Thornton and Jack Besh, and you can't lose sight of Tommy Mellott, the quarterback turning to wide receiver as well. But how do you see that? And you got to throw Trey Tucker in there as well. So after you start talking about Jacoby Myers, after you start talking about Brock Bowers, the one and two options for this pass game, how does it fall in line after that? When you're talking about Trey Tucker, when you're talking about Michael Mayer, when you're talking about Dante Thornton, when you're talking about Jack Besh, the possibility of Tommy getting on the field pretty early. And then you got to throw in the running backs as well. So we'll get into that. We'll dive into some of the numbers because Ashton Jeanty, I believe, is going to be a big part of this passing offense, and he's going to get a hefty load of targets as well. How do you see that playing out? 702-365-9200. We got a great show for you today at 12:45. A good friend of the show, good friend of mine, Rich Ornberger, the former NFL player, played many years in the NFL, played in New England, played for the San Diego Chargers. He'll be in at 12:45. He now works for Fox Radio to talk about the upcoming season, the Chargers, the Raiders, everything under the NFL sun. And then at 1:30, Ryan Hoag, the former Raider wide receiver, Mr. Irrelevant, although there's nothing irrelevant about him here. Ryan's going to join us at 1:30 to talk about how he sees this wide receiver room playing out and how the pecking order and what that pecking order might look like. And I'm throwing this question out to our listeners, 702-365-9200. How do you see this playing out? Because it's really interesting. You know, when you look at Brock Bowers, he got 153 targets last year, ended up with, 112 catches. But, you know, I'm no big mathematician, but 153 targets, the 112, you know, catches, that's a record-breaking amount of catches for a rookie tight end. That's absurd numbers for a young tight end. But when you think about the fact that he also got targeted 153 times, you don't have to be a real mathematician to figure out that, you know, 153 minus 112, there were a lot of balls that didn't make their way, that were intended for Brock Bowers, that didn't accomplish the ultimate goal, which is being secured by Brock Bowers. And I'll say this right now. I saw every single game. I was at every single game. There was no fault of Brock Bowers. I can maybe count on one finger the amount of drops that he had, if he really even had any legitimate drops. I'll give him, let's just say, three or four. You know, maybe we'll look back and see that there were a little bit more, but there was nothing blatant about, his drops. So when you look at that disparity, the 153 to the 112, there were some balls that were thrown Brock Bowers' way that just never made them to Brock Bowers, and that was with the quarterbacks that the Raiders had last year. Does that change? Do the targets stay the same, but the catches go up? Because there's more catchable balls being thrown by Geno Smith, right? So that's number one. Number two, obviously, Jacoby Myers was number two on that list in terms of the targets. Ended up with over 1,000 yards receiving. I don't expect that to change that much. So you could almost write in pen, as long as Jacoby and Brock stay healthy, that you're looking at 150, 120, you know, close to 300, close to, let's say, 250 targets, 260, 270 targets that are just going to be designated for Jacoby Myers and Brock Bowers. That seems healthy. That seems right. That's who you want to get the ball into the hands of as many times as you possibly can. Those are your two primary weapons in this offense when it comes to the pass game. After that, who would be number two, and who would be next in line in terms of the targets? Do you want to go Trey Tucker? Do you want to go Jack Besh? Do you want to go Michael Mayer? Do you want to go Dante Thornton? What about, Ashton Jeanty? I would think, when you think about Ashton Jeanty and everything that he's going to mean to this offense, you're probably looking at 55 to 65 targets right there. Wouldn't you want to get on the ball? I went back and looked at Geno Smith last year. He threw, I think it was 109 targets to his running backs in Seattle. So, is there 100 balls out there for the running backs for the Raiders this year? Raheem Mostert and Ashton Jeanty, and how does that get divided up? If it is 100 targets to the running backs, or 112 targets to the running backs, how do you divide that between those two, between Raheem and Ashton Jeanty? I would lean toward 60 plus for Ashton and 40 plus maybe for Raheem. How does that play out? But as far as that number two receiver, or I guess we'd have to say number three receiving option behind Brock Bowers, behind Jacoby Myers, take the running backs out of it for a second. Is it going to be Michael Mayer? He had 31 targets last year in 11 games. Remember, he missed a big chunk of time. And even when he was out there, it always felt like he was not being utilized as much as he probably should. But you go back and look, 11 games, 31, 32 targets, had 20-plus receptions. If he plays a full schedule this year, 17 games, you take 30 over 11 and probably more usage based on what we saw in OTAs and minicamp. Could we be talking about 70 targets at this point, or 65 targets for Michael Mayer, maybe a little bit more than that? And what is that going to equate to in terms of production? Then you look at Jack Besh. Here's a guy that in OTAs and minicamp was typically running with the second team. He was the second team slot wide receiver, basically plays Jacoby Myers' position. Yep, we saw more of Dante Thornton with the first team, but I would caution that was more situationally based. And obviously, he, as Chip Kelly was talking about, he plays more of that outside wide receiver. That's when you want to draw up what an outside wide receiver looks like in the NFL. If you were to have a prototype, a 6'5" burner like Dante Thornton would be exactly what you dream up, what you conjure up. So there's a player that in OTAs and minicamp was getting a lot of first team reps. When the Raiders typically went to 11 personnel, which was three wide receivers on the field, and quite often when they were in 13 personnel, or 12 personnel, I should say, where it was two wide receivers, he was in there, but you always had to kind of look at what was the down and distance, what was the period that they were working on, was it the red zone, was it short yardage? So I wouldn't say that play in and play out, he's going to be for sure a starting player, but I will say that at least it feels like the plan is anyway to get him on the field in situations. And what does that mean for Dante Thornton's, target count? And then there's Jack Besh that we just mentioned. He plays the same position as Jakobi Meyers, but I believe, this is my thoughts anyway, he's such a versatile player, and I think that he's, at this point, probably the more polished wide receiver in terms of the route running, the understanding of the position, all the various things that he can do, the more polished or advanced wide receiver at this point, as opposed to Dante Thornton, who's still kind of a work in progress because of the offense that he played in at Tennessee. I think as the year goes on, a guy like Jack Besh is going to make a compelling case for himself to be on the field more often than not, not as a replacement for Jakobi Meyers, but in conjunction with Jakobi Meyers. I think as the season goes on and the more the Raiders see of Jack Besh, the more Geno Smith develops chemistry with Jack Besh, I could see him kind of forcing his way onto the field, maybe a little bit more as it plays out than a Dante Thornton, who I'm not trying to shortchange him or anything like that, but I think there's a little bit more of a learning curve there, and maybe he's going to be a little bit more situationally based, whereas a Jack Besh can play in any situation at any given time in any personnel grouping. And don't sleep, honestly, on Trey Tucker. This is a guy that had, was it 80-plus targets last year, finished with 40-plus receptions. So in his second year, he was starting to take strides. Be remiss not to mention, again, the quarterback play, the level of quarterback play that existed here with the Raiders last year. It was bottom of the NFL, and that was reflected in all of the numbers across the board. And it was also reflected in the ratio of targets to actual catches, because, yes, there's always going to be drop passes. That's just a given and a factor of the NFL. But there were far more balls that were just quite honestly off target, thrown off target last year because of those, because of the quarterbacks and the level of quarterback play. That should improve with Geno Smith out there being one of the most accurate passers in the NFL, if not the most accurate passer in the NFL. That's what you're exchanging here when you go from Gardner Minshew and Aiden O'Connell, who were just barely above 60% completion percentage last year, to a guy in Geno Smith who we're talking about 69-70% completion percentage. That's a huge difference mathematically and in terms of success rate, actually throwing balls that these wide receivers now and tight ends are going to be able to get to and then do damage with. So what are your thoughts, 702-365-9200, on how this is all going to play out in terms of that pecking order? And it's interesting when you watch the Raiders during OTAs in minicamp, kind of how it did play out. Obviously, it goes without saying where Brock Bowers is in the hierarchy of things. But we've been talking a lot about and Jakobi Meyers. Those are your two givens right there. But it's that third spot. It's that third, third in line on that pecking order that's super intriguing to me, and I can see it playing out in any number of ways. I could actually see it playing out with those young wide receivers that they all kind of rotate in and out. There won't be necessarily an established number two wide receiver option behind Jakobi Meyers and in the whole pecking order that would make that person number three. Maybe that's a composite, of a number of different guys, and it's going to be based on what the down and distance is, where they are in the field, what the score is, what the personnel package is, in terms of maybe it just gets divided fairly evenly. We'll see how that all plays out. But somebody like a Michael Mayer, who we've been talking a lot about, for the last couple of years, and somebody who, quite frankly, I felt has not been used and utilized as well as he probably should have been. There's been some circumstance. Number one, you go back to year one. The Raiders traded up to get him in the second round. They really liked him, obviously. I think the plan initially was They were going to develop him as an all-around tight end. They wanted him to learn to block. That became a real focal point that first year of his career. Let's build you up to be a solid to above average blocker in this attack, in Josh McDaniels' attack. And I thought it was a struggle early on. He'd be the first to tell you that. But as the season went on, that became a strength of Michael Mayer's. He developed into a really good, solid blocking tight end. And as the year kind of went on, they started throwing the ball his way or getting him more involved in the offense. I just kept waiting and waiting and waiting because I felt like every time they did throw him the ball, the guy made things happen. And it just baffled me why there wasn't more intentionality to get Michael Mayer the ball. He had his body changed a little bit from year one to year two. That happens. He became a little bit more athletic, a little bit quicker, a little bit twitchier. He really went to work on that part of his game. Lo and behold, though, the Raiders draft a guy by the name of Brock Bowers, who all you had to do was look at the film at Georgia to understand, yeah, this guy is going to pop here with the Raiders. There's really no question of that, and that's exactly what he did. So that cut into some of Michael Mayer's targets and that sort of thing. And then there was the personal issues that he was dealing with that sidelined him for six games, I think about 8 weeks in total. So that interrupted things. But even when he was here, I felt like the Raiders could have done a better job getting him more involved. And you fast forward to this year, and you look at what happened in OTAs, and you look at what happened in minicamp, and the times that we were out there, I think it was six total practices that the media was allowed to watch. It was really conspicuous how much Michael Mayer was involved in the passing game. They really made it a priority, it felt, to get him involved, to throw him the ball. And I think that's something that needs to continue, and it's partly on Michael Mayer. He needs to be available. He needs to be where he's supposed to be. He needs to hold on to the ball when they throw it to him. Not that I think that that's an issue, but these are all factors that play into, look, we're going to go to you, we're going to feed you, but now you got to do your part of this by not just holding on to the ball, but going ahead and making things happen with the football. I expect that will be the case. And if that is the case, then I think he's going to get fed more. That's how you build trust. That's how you put conviction and confidence into the quarterback, into the coaches to get your number called. And I think that's going to happen. So I can definitely see a scenario where Michael Mayer might be that number three, along with maybe a Jack Besh. We're going to get into all of that. We're going to get into some numbers. I want your thoughts. 702-365-9200. Give me a call. Text me. Let me know how you see this playing out. Who knows? Maybe you think that the Raiders need to go sign somebody else. Whatever your thoughts are, 702-5-9200, let me know.
To the JT the Brick Show with your host for today, Vinny Bonsignor, only on Raider Nation Radio 920 AM.
You know what? It's my job to throw him the ball and get it to him in the right places and make it easy on him, make the catches easy for him. I know he's going to make great catches and make me look good all the time. So my job is to make sure that I'm feeding him the ball and getting the ball in the right spots and, you know, allow him to go out there and be great and, you know, get a shine on.
That was Geno Smith talking about Jacoby Myers, who I think we could all agree is the number two reception option or target option in the pass game behind Brock Bowers. That was the case last year, 153 targets for Brock Bowers, just over 100 targets for Jacoby Myers. I think that will remain the same this year. My question for those two will be, is the success rate going to be increase because you've got a better quarterback now throwing them the ball? So, you know, of those 153 targets, if that stays status quo for Brock Bowers, how many more catches is he going to have compared to the 112 he had last year, because there's going to be more catchable balls thrown his way by a much more precise throwing, accurate throwing quarterback. And the same goes for Jakobi Meyers. And it's really interesting about Jakobi Meyers, because we all know he's going into the last year of his contract. And this kind of all sort of intertwines a little bit. We talked about the investment that the Raiders made at wide receiver during the draft with Jack Besh, with Dante Thornton, and with Tommy Mellott. And obviously, they felt the need to lengthen that room and to get younger, and to bring in more potential and more young players that they hope are going to be part of the long range solution. There's no question about that. But could it also mean that one of those players becomes the de facto heir apparent to a Jakobi Meyers if Jakobi balls out like we all expect him to? What's that going to mean monetarily for him? And are the Raiders, going to have a decision to make on their hands of do they pay what that top dollar might be now for Jakobi Meyers? I think they'd gladly do that, especially if they don't feel comfortable that somebody behind him, your Jack Beshes or your Dante Thornton is going to be, ready to sort of fill those shoes come next year. It's a longer range problem, but that day is coming pretty soon. And you do wonder, with all the investments that they made in that wide receiver, what that might mean for Jakobi Meyers, a long range future with the Raiders. There's no question that he's one of the better number two wide receivers in the NFL. He's obviously established. He's obviously accomplished. He obviously can help the Raiders win right now. But there is a financial aspect to this game. Not to say that the Raiders aren't willing to spend money. That's not what I'm saying whatsoever. It's how you spend your money. You've got 52 other spots on your roster to account for. That's 53 pieces of a massive puzzle that has to fit under a salary cap. How might the Raiders handle that, especially if one of the young wide receivers is ready to go starting next year to be a primary guy? We'll see how that all plays out. But at least for this year, I think Jakobi Meyers obviously is going to be a big part of this offense, as will Brock Bowers. The question is, who fills in behind them in terms of the targets? We're going to go out to the Raider Nation radio listener line, because Mitch is in New Jersey. How you doing, Mitch?
Hello, Vinny. How's it going today?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Great. Yeah, pretty good. Enjoying it. Enjoying my day.
Good for you.
Getting ready for my grandson to give me a heck yet. Thank you for working so much. Nice to hear you.
No worries.
This year from last year, it's not really fair to the quarterback. This year, we have so much this year for Geno Smith, the starting quarterback, for him to throw to. And he's got a running game. I'm assuming the three wide receivers have made the team, because you don't know yet, but I think they will. So Brock Bowers, he gets less targets, less catches. It's only because there's more talent around him. I think the offense is going to be the best part of his team. Just curious how many sacks you can get. And I think I feel well with who we drafted besides Max. I'm liking what they have done with this team. And Pete Carroll, he never really get a fair shake. I think he's going to, he doesn't have that many years left, I think. So he's going to make the best of it. We're going to have 10 wins. Get to the point here. Anyway, Vinny, thanks for taking my call.
All right, man. I appreciate it. It's funny because, a guy that I think, gets a little bit marginalized right now, and even as I am approaching training camp and this season, when you start thinking about what the roles are going to look like for everybody, what the development track that all these young players are going to be on, you could definitely see Jack Besh being a prime time player this year. Certainly in the pecking order behind Brock Bowers and behind Jakobi Meyers, but somebody that's going to, I think, emerge as a darn good player and a really good option for the Raiders. I think Dante Thornton, based on what we saw in OTAs and minicamp, at the very least a situational player, whether it's in the red zone, whether it's on deep balls, and then build off of that. I think, by the end of the year, the Raiders are going to feel pretty good about where they are with Dante Thornton where he is. The bigger question for me is what kind of a season can we expect from a Tommy Mellott? Again, making the transition from quarterback at Montana State, a very good one, highly athletic, extremely explosive, tests off the charts, can run, does damage when the ball is in his hands. He's a guy that, you know, when you talk to Raider people, that's the thing that really jumps out. Put the ball in Tommy's hands and good things happen. He makes things happen with the ball in his hands. So how can you figure out a way for a player that's making a transition from quarterback to wide receiver to maximize that in his rookie year? Or, is he strictly sort of a redshirt guy this year because of circumstance, because of, you know, where they are on the depth chart at wide receiver? And does he sort of take this season to really work on his game and work on that transition? And the comp that I keep getting for Tommy Mellott is Julian Edelman. Julian Edelman played quarterback at Kent State in college. It was a pretty darn good one, but like Tommy, a dynamic playmaker with the ball in his hands, could run, could catch, could do a lot of different things. The Patriots drafted him. Bill Belichick famously got him on the phone and said, look, we don't know what the hell position you play, but you seem like you could do some things on the football field. We'll get you down here or up here to New England, and we'll figure it out. Hang up. That's it. You know, and so good luck to you, Julian Edelman. Well, you look at Julian Edelman's first year in the NFL. He was 23 years old, making the transition again from college quarterback to college to NFL wide receiver. And he played 11 games in his first season, made 7 starts, played 11 games. Missed obviously some time due to either injury or didn't dress out. I'll go back and check that out. But, you know, here's a guy that in his rookie season still had 54 targets. And this is on a team that had Wes Welker. Wes Welker had 123 targets that year for 1,348 yards. Randy Moss, the wide receiver. And by the way, Wes Welker, that was in 14 games. So he missed 2 games that year. Had 162 targets for 123 receptions, 1,348 yards. Randy Moss was the number 2 target that year, 137 targets, 83 catches for 1,264 yards. That's just tremendous production right there, 15.2 yards per catch. Number 3 on that list was Julian Edelman. He figured out a way to get on the field pretty darn quick. And ended up with 54 targets, 37 catches for 359 yards. Kevin Falk played a role in that. He got involved in the offense. So when you look at somebody like a Tommy Mellott, are we putting it past him that he can reproduce what a Julian Edelman did his rookie year with the New England Patriots, figuring out a way, even though he was making a transition from one position to the next in as far as playing NFL wide receiver after being a quarterback in the NFL. It seems to me like he did it pretty quick. You know, that's not bad production for Julian Edelman. Can Tommy Mellott figure out a way to do a similar or have similar production? And that makes him kind of a wild card to me, because I'm trying to figure out, all right, where's the room for him? Where are the plays from scrimmage going to come from? Whose place is he going to be taking? What does that mean for Jack Besh, and what does that mean for Dante Thornton, and et cetera, et cetera? But as the Patriots showed, you know, and Julian Edelman showed, don't necessarily write him off, Tommy Mellott, just because he is making that transition right now. If he can, and look, coaches, baseball managers, whoever you talk to, anytime you ask them about playing time, they'll always be the good ones will always say, look, it's almost out of my hands. The players decide playing time. They decide with work ethic. They decide with preparation, with understanding the playbook, with being ready when called upon, by producing when they are playing. It's the players who dictate who gets out on the field. And can Tommy Mellott, figure out a way to have an impact as a rookie? And say this as well. And we saw this during OTAs and minicamp. I told somebody with the Raiders when they drafted him, if I'm Tommy Mellott, I am investing in a jugs machine, the kind that can shoot me punts and shoot me kickoffs, because I'm going to master that. I'm going to give the Raiders no reason whatsoever to not have me on the field on kickoff returns and punt returns, kind of like what Julian Edelman did with the New England Patriots and became a really dynamic punt returner in the return game. If I'm Tommy Mellott and I know that it's going to be a struggle sometimes to get on the field with the regular offense because of who's out there in front of me, I'm going to make darn sure you understand that I'm really good at in the return game. And again, I go back to what people in the Raiders building understand, and one of the reasons why they invested the draft pick in him was he's dynamic with the ball, and it's on them, it's on the Raiders to figure out a way to get him the ball, whether it's this year or certainly down the road. But if you want to try to tap into him immediately, it feels like special teams would be a great way to go, because when you think about the new kickoff rules and how they adjusted it, remember, when you're talking about kicking the ball out of the end zone, which happened far too often last year after they changed to the dynamic kickoff rules, you kicked it out of the end zone on a touchback. The opposing offense got the ball at the 30-yard line. I know early on it was, okay, let's kind of figure this out to decide whether to kick it off or whether to kick it out of out of the end zone and just give them the ball at the 30-yard line. Well, what they ultimately found out, most teams, through the first couple of weeks of the season, is that whether you kicked it out of the end zone or kicked it off, generally speaking, the return game was getting the ball somewhere between the 25 and 30 yard line. So that's where the averages were playing out, right? So kickoff teams just decided, special teams and teams just decided, look, if they're going to get the ball regardless between that 26 or 30 yard line, why are we even taking a chance on kicking it off? Just give them the ball at the 30-yard line. We can survive. We can live with that rather than risk hurting our players, risk getting a penalty, and all of a sudden the 30 becomes the 45-yard line, or risk, worse off than that, a break in the coverage, and all of a sudden, the other team's taking the ball the other way, and now they're on the other side of the field, if not your end zone. So to mitigate all of those negatives that could happen on the kickoff, a penalty, an injury, or a break free in the return game, just give them the ball at the 30-yard line. So that made a lot of sense, which is why most teams just kicked it out of the end zone and lived with the consequences of the other team getting the ball at the 30-yard line. The NFL, that a league that wants the kickoff to be a big part of this game, but in the safest way possible, said, all right, so that's what the response was. Teams just kicked it out of the end zone. There goes our hopes of getting more kickoffs, more kickoff returns, and reintroducing the kickoff return for fans and for the game of football. We're going to have to take it one step further. So they went back to the drawing board this offseason and said, all right, so since you were okay with it going to the 30-yard line on touchbacks, we're just going to now move that to the 35-yard line. And all statistics will show and tell you that when an offense gets the ball at their 35-yard line or above, or further down, but let's just say the 35-yard line, as opposed to the 25 or the 30 or the 26 or the 27, teams are far more likely to score points, whether it's a field goal or a touchdown, with the starting point being at the 35-yard line. Therein lies the NFL's pivot or adjustment to put the ball at the 35-yard line, which now makes it a much harder decision to just kick it out of bounds and say, yeah, we'll live with the fact that the other team is going to get the ball at the 35-yard line, knowing that all the statistics show that there's a good chance that they're going to score as a result of that. So now opposing teams that are kicking off have an easier decision to make, basically. They're not going to be kicking the ball out of the end zone and just handing the 35-yard line off to the opponents. What they're going to do is kick it off and then just go cover it and hope that they knock it down before they get anywhere near the 35-yard line. They'll accept now that 25 to 29-yard ratio, which is what the averages showed last year when they were actually kicking it off. So that's going to be now a play where somebody back there on each team is going to get a whole lot of chances now to do something with the ball in their hands, which brings us to Tommy Mellott and what he might mean in the kickoff game and where that what that means for his spot on the roster, which I think he's going to make the team. But I'm talking more about being in the rotation, being dressed out for the game day, as opposed to maybe redshirting, where you're on the team, you're practicing, come game day, you're probably not going to dress out. No big worry. We've seen it time and time again where players that began their careers in that kind of situation, on that development track, end up paying off in a big major way down the road. But can Tommy Mellott be so dynamic in the special teams game, especially in that kickoff game, that the Raiders say, we need him dressed out every game because he means that much to the kickoff? Or is it going to be Kyle Phillips? Or is it going to be Dante Thornton? Or is it going to be, Dylan Lobby? We can't discount him. You know, he did have a 59-yard kickoff return last year. So is the young running back going to be the guy that says, no, I'm the guy that they need to, that you should, you know, kick off or have back there, as far as the kickoff. So we'll see how that all plays out. I'm intrigued by Tommy Mellott. I'm intrigued by what his role could be, whether it's in the offense or in special teams. I'm extremely intrigued by Jack Besh and what he's going to carve out for himself, as well as Dante Thornton. I think right now Jack Besh is the more advanced wide receiver. But things change, and I'll say this for Dante Thornton. He looked a lot more advanced than I thought he would when we first, you know, based on what we saw at Tennessee and then what we saw of him at OTAs and minicamp. It's the JT the Brick Show, 702-365-9200. Give us a call on what you think or how you think that target disposition or target distribution is going to turn out.
Back to the JT the Brick Show with your host for today, Vinny Bonsignor, only on Raider Nation Radio 920 AM.
I like him a lot, actually. I like him a lot, actually. I didn't know much about him coming out, but now that he's here, just seeing the different parts of his game, like, he's not just a guy that can run fast. Like, he got some real receiver capabilities to him. So I'm excited to kind of help grow him and help push him along and just see what he could do on the field when the pass come on.
That's Raider wide receiver Jacoby Myers talking about young Dante Thornton from University of Tennessee, a rookie wide receiver that Jacoby's obviously taken under his wing, but is also somebody that has kind of turned some heads with the Raiders this year, including, you know, Ashton Jeanty has done the same thing, Jack Besh as well. It's really this rookie class has really, you know, made quite a statement during OTAs and minicamp, and we'll see if that continues into the regular season and into training camp. But talk about that and many other things in the NFL. Want to welcome in our good friend Rich Ornberger. He was a former player at Penn State University, played for the Patriots, the Cardinals, and the Chargers. He's also, you can hear him on Sports 760, also Fox Sports Radio. He's also an analyst for San Diego State Football, which is playing the last year in the Mountain West. Heartbreaker, but they're going to, you know, move on to the Pac-12 here in 1 second. First, or 1 year. Rich, number one, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it. But I got to ask you this, you know, when you're a veteran player and you get to, you know, mini camp and OTAs, and you start getting introduced to some of these rookie players that are on your team, how quickly do you guys start noticing some of the players and saying, oh, man, this guy might be able to help us sooner rather than later?
Well, immediately, especially if they're playing in your position or your position group, if they're in your meeting room, meaning your positional room, you know, so as offensive linemen, it's really quickly that you discover which young guys really have what it takes and which ones need a lot of work. And there's obviously gray area in between, but then it expands from there. So as an offensive lineman, obviously I could speak to my position group. But then you work with the quarterbacks, you know, you work in concert with the quarterbacks every single practice. And you can tell really quick which quarterbacks have really been studying their playbook, or guys who really seem to understand it or get it, I guess is another way to put it. You know, you work alongside the tight ends in certain blocking schemes, so you get to see how they're working with the tackles, especially. You know, so even though you're working the most closely with your positional group, it's pretty obvious which guys have the stuff and which guys, you know, need a little work. And the other thing you learn as a veteran, the longer you play is, you know, just because a guy's struggling early doesn't mean he isn't going to make it. Doesn't mean he doesn't have the chops. It doesn't mean that he doesn't have the tools to make it work at this level, because there's a steep learning curve coming from college football, and everybody enters that curve at a different point. Some guys are really far down the ladder, and some guys are closer to the top.
So when it comes to some of the players that whose learning curve might be a little bit steeper, what are you looking for as a veteran player from them to give you, you know, some confidence that they're going to eventually get it? Or how quickly can sometimes you realize, like, I don't know if this guy has what it takes to complete that learning curve, because I'm not seeing what I want to see in terms of the work ethic and the habits?
Yeah, that's a great question, and really kind of nailed it there. It's the habits. It's the effort. Those are the things that you notice first. Is the guy showing up on time? Is the guy early? You know, is the guy, you know, taking the time to study his playbook? You know, when he's called upon in these meetings, is he providing the correct answers? Essentially, Vinny, is he controlling the controllables? There are so many things that are outside of your control. You're going to run into a stronger athlete, a better athlete who's opposing you on the field sometimes. You know, you're going to run into situations where you're facing a defense maybe you never even saw when you were playing college football. Maybe, you know, if you're a defensive player, you're facing a play that over the course of your entire career playing, you were never exposed to. And so that's going to happen. Everybody's going to get caught. Even a veteran of many, many years in the NFL is going to get caught. But can you learn from those mistakes? You know, so those are the things that stick out with a guy who may be starting at a lower rung on the ladder or has a steeper learning curve, is that guy controlling the controllables? Because if you're doing that much, there's a lot left to work with as long as you have, you know, the baseline tools and skills and athleticism you need to compete at the NFL level.
We're talking to Rich Auenberger, our good friend, former NFL player, a great personality now in his own right, over at Sports 760. He's also a host at Fox Sports Radio and an analyst with San Diego State University football. Rich, I'm curious, a lot of changes have been happening with the Raiders. That's kind of a redundant statement over the last 5 years, but it feels like this change in particular that they've experienced since the end of last season. Tom Brady, now part of ownership, you know, Pete Carroll, the head coach, Chip Kelly, the offensive coordinator, Geno Smith, the quarterback, Ashton Jeanty, their running back, and I think is going to be a big focal point of this offense. From an outsider's view, I'm curious what the view of the Raiders is right now, and how much curiosity and maybe even some optimism outside this room that the Raiders could be back on the right track.
I'm really excited for the Raiders this upcoming season, and it's for, you know, it's not for just one specific position group on the team. I mean, it's for a lot of different reasons. And I mean, look, when I'm evaluating a team in the preseason, it is so hard to fathom how all these puzzle pieces are going to come together in the first place, especially with a new staff, especially, you know, with incoming players every year anyway. So even if you have a consistent team, you know they're going to be losing some players in trade or free agency, or they're going to be onboarding new talent through the draft or free agency, you know, guys who are signed as undrafted free agents out of college. So there's going to be change every year, regardless of, you know, whether or not there's no regime change. But especially with the team with regime change, what are the focal points? Every team comes down to, in my opinion, head coach and competency at quarterback. If you go through historically and you look at those two positions, if you have competency at head coach and you have competency at quarterback, you've got a chance. Now you have something to work with. And I think the Raiders have both. I think the Pete Carroll hire was a smart hire. I think that Pete obviously has proven himself to have a methodology, both from how he interacts with the players, how he builds a roster and a roster that works at this level. And then you look at Geno, and Geno's the type of player who at very least is going to be able to manage every game and every situation you put him in. And at most, he can play at a Pro Bowl level. Now, what Geno are you going to get? We'll see. But you have competency at head coach and you have competency at quarterback. And so you have a lot. You're at a great starting spot. And then you start sprinkling in some of the other names, the Ashton Jeffies that people are excited about from the NFL draft and the Chip Kellys. And, you know, this staff has improved, in my opinion. It's an exciting time to be a Las Vegas Raider fan.
Last question for you, and we appreciate your time. I could talk to you forever, but unfortunately, a short stint this time. The Chargers have made, obviously, some changes as well. Jim Harbaugh now going into year two. They addressed some needs in the draft. As you sit here assessing the Chargers going into year two under Jim Harbaugh, how much further along right now are they compared to this time last year?
The Chargers definitely still have some work to do. And if you remember Jim Harbaugh's early years with the Michigan Wolverines, it wasn't, you know, a smooth ride. I mean, they were immediately better, and so were the Chargers with Jim Harbaugh when he arrived. But there were a lot of kinks that needed to be worked out. And I think part of the kinks that need to be worked out when you're implanting a system like Jim Harbaugh's is you need buy-in. You need to find a bunch of guys who fit your system. He's not the type of coach who's going to walk through the doors and he's going to say, okay, let's see what kind of talent we have, and I'm going to fit my system to the talent. It's more rigid than that. And that's not necessarily a complaint or a criticism. It's just a reality. The reality is certain coaches, they bring with them a system, and that system has worked everywhere Jim Harbaugh has coached. And so he's building that system. Do I think the Chargers are going to compete for a Super Bowl in year two? Most likely not. Do I expect them to show improvement, especially in the run game, especially in the play action game, and especially at the line of scrimmage defensively? Absolutely, because those have been hallmarks for Jim Harbaugh over the entirety of his career coaching. If you look at him when he was with USD or with Stanford or with the San Francisco 49ers before he took the Michigan job, or even last year with the Chargers, that is baked into his genetics as a head coach. So those are the places I expect to see the most growth from the Chargers in year two.
Absolutely. And if nothing else, we've got Pete Carroll versus Jim Harbaugh times three, or round three, I guess, college, the NFC West, and now the AFC West. I can't wait till Monday night, second week of the season, when the Chargers and Raiders lock horns here at Allegiant Stadium. Rich, we'll definitely get you on that week for sure. I really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us on short notice. Take care, my good friend, and we'll see you down the road.
Yeah, love being on with you, Vinny, anytime.
Likewise. That's Rich Orenberger. Our thanks to him. A lot of optimism, even in their neck of the woods out in Southern California, covering the Chargers, that the Raiders are on the right track. I completely agree with Rich Orenberger. It's really a matter of how quickly it comes together.